So why don't we start with the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, thy will, not mine, be done. This section of our program today is the combination of Step 2 and Tradition 2, subtitled Trust. Because if we accept Step 1, as I maintained earlier, that means accepting that we're in deep doo-doo. This is an image that often comes to my mind when I think about what it is that we're, what it felt like I was being asked to do in 12-step recovery. And this is a very, for me, really wrenching image. I think about the people in the towers on 9/11 who jumped, and what it took to be at that moment of deciding the best option available to me right now is to jump. Now, I can imagine myself being in that position of just, this is the only option available to me, even knowing, but that amount of desperation. Now, the reason that I have that image is just of that feeling. In the big book, it talks in step two, I believe, about a dilemma. And a dilemma is, for those of you who like language, a dilemma doesn't mean problem. It's a particular kind of a problem. Look at the word, die. And the way it is often phrased is on the horns of a dilemma. There are two horns on this beast. And it means being presented with two equally unpalatable choices. And in the big book, it said this was our dilemma, to go something like, and I'm paraphrasing, to go on, I believe, blotting out the knowledge of our own intolerable condition, or to accept spiritual help. To me, what I was being asked to do in step two was that unpalatable. When I came to 12-step fellowship, I was not one of those people who would have described themselves as being rigidly atheist or even agnostic. I didn't really have that much aversion to the idea of God. As a matter of fact, I thought I believed in God, but the idea of trusting and relying on God was that horrible, which meant that I actually didn't have any belief in God at all. Because by pretty much, and as you know, somebody earlier was talking about their reluctance to use the word God, because when they say it, it's probably not the way you mean it. And that's the way I believe it too, I use it because it's what we agree upon. It is, we are talking about some power that is not us. So I give everybody, you know, the same permission that I give myself, which is, you know, when I use the word, run it through your own filter, as I do. But the idea that I was going to trust this amorphous mass with every detail of my life, with every outcome, with what was to become of me, was, as it seemed, as scary and as unpalatable, interesting choice of words, as continuing on the way I was. The thing was, that was the devil I knew. I knew what it meant. I knew what it felt like to run my own life. It wasn't very good, but I knew what it was like. I still, to some extent, thought that I was in charge, and that I could determine the course of it. And over the years, after I got into Overeaters Anonymous, I think the reality of how doomed I really was has sunk in more and more. Probably still have never grasped it, because I've never yet, thank God, had to go to the places that I could have gone. But I really, really was terrified, disturbed, angered at this idea of turning it over. You know, just the phrase itself kind of gave me the willies. There's another phrase in the big book that still kind of gives me the chills every time I hear it. When it says, when we became alcoholics, compulsive eaters, faced, page 53, I think, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God was everything or he was nothing. He is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And that, I think, is really both, again, this is another one of those paradoxes. That's both the wonderful thing about step two for me and the horrible thing about step two for me, because it really is kind of an all or nothing thing. So, you know, there's that bumper sticker that says, God is my co-pilot. And what I've come to believe is, you know, then somebody's sitting in the wrong seat. You know, I don't want to be flying this plane. But the other thing about that sentence is it says, what was our choice to be? And what that was asking me to do, and that's what this program was asking me to do, was not sit around and wait until this belief that it talks about in step two fell on me. It was asking me to move ahead in action as if I believed and just resign the debating societies, it says elsewhere. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Not came to believe in a power greater than myself that would restore me to sanity. That's a very important distinction. Had I had to wait until I believed in God, whatever that means, until I moved forward, I would still be, well, I don't know what I would be, but I would not have stopped at 215 pounds of chain-smoking suicidal fun. Because I moved forward not knowing and not believing. But what I did believe was that there was such a power, and I believed it was possible for me to have this. That I did believe. And there's a wonderful way of making the distinction between, I believe, belief and faith that I heard on a set of speaker tapes, these guys, Charlie and Joe, many of you have heard of them, I'm sure. And they made the distinction thusly. I moved to a new town. My car needs fixing. And I don't know any mechanics, but I go to my neighbor and they say, you know, take it to Mike's. He's really good. He'll treat you fairly, won't overcharge you. And I ask somebody else at work and they say, oh yeah, Mike, he's really good. I've been taking my car there for years. At this point, I have no faith in Mike because I have no experience of Mike. So I have nothing on which to base my actions except for your faith. But I believe you. You have no reason to lie to me. None of you had a reason to lie to me. So I believed, that you had faith. And so I take my car to Mike's. He does a good job. Now I have faith in Mike because now I have experience. So today I have faith in this power because I have experience of this power. But first I had to believe that it could work for me. That was all step two asked me to do. And that requires trust. Trust in this program. In tradition, too, the word trust is used as well because it talks about the thing that also a lot of people find really baffling when they come to Overeaters Anonymous, the idea that we really don't have any major hierarchy kind of thing, that we are all equally responsible for keeping Overeaters Anonymous going. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. So the idea here is that the group decides what the group is going to do, and the leaders, the people who hold offices such as, you know, group secretary, treasurer, chairperson, chair of intergroup, all of the other offices that are in OA, are trusted to carry out the conscience of the group. And because we are living our lives on a spiritual basis, we trust that what we decide is expressing God through us because we're trying to live according to God's will. However, that said, you know, I gave an example this morning of how Overeaters Anonymous made a decision and several years later decided that it wanted to change that decision. Did it mean that it wasn't following God's will when it made the decision? I really have no idea. But the process was followed, and then the process again was followed, and the decision was changed. And I think anybody here can think of examples of that happening. Sometimes it's simply, you know, that wasn't such a great thing, we don't really like the results, we're going to revisit that. Or sometimes it was just, it was great for then, now it's later, it's different. The same thing happens with our personal recovery. I mean, has anybody's food plan changed over the years? Yeah. What worked for me 10 years ago doesn't work for me now. I can't incorporate that many calories into my day. I can't use them, you know, unless I take up marathon running, which is not likely. And likewise, I can't eat the food plan that I ate 20 years ago it wasn't structured enough. Over time, I've learned more about myself, and so what worked for me then to feel that I was abstaining from compulsive eating would not be acceptable to me now. All of this was all of these decisions were reached through trying to live a spiritual path in consultation with sponsors and other OA members so that I was no longer doing everything by self-will. Again, I had to rely upon the unity of the fellowship of other people in order to access what seemed to be God's will for me. I needed help. The exercise that we're going to be doing this afternoon is about that combination of step two and tradition two. And again, it talks, the exercise itself talks about our lives in our groups. And if you're terrifically new to Overeaters Anonymous, it's very possible you've never attended a business meeting. You may not have gone to enough different meetings to have a very strong opinion on how meetings should be run or anything like that. So take it for what it is. Believe me, stick around long enough and attend a few business meetings. You'll have opinions. I think a lot of you will back me up on that one. But I want to talk a little bit before we break into our groups about my personal experience of some of those decisions and some of those choices that I was faced with. So the first thing that I talked about it earlier today, how it felt to start coming to Overeaters Anonymous, and one of the first beliefs that I formed was, I believe you people when you say that you are abstaining from eating certain foods. I believe you when you say that you do not eat in between meals or that you weigh and measure. I also believe that that will never be possible for me. And so, because of that belief, I was afraid to try, because I was afraid to fail. The idea of weighing and measuring and following a food plan just looked like another diet to me, and I'd already had a lot of experience of failing at those. And so it took me a while to believe you when you said, it's different. It may look the same, but it is different. You just have to trust us, and you only need to try it. You can only try it for one day. That was one of the first things that I had to open my mind to trust, that this was possible for me. Next, after I'd been, then, the next thing I knew, several months later, the next thing I knew, was that I was abstinent, and one day followed the next, and it really was one day at a time, because and my first food plan was this, 3 meals a day with nothing in between, and it did not matter what those meals were. Today it has to matter, but back then, it did not matter. Within, I believe, a week or two, food plan excluded sugar. That was the first thing to go after a short time of just trying to, limit my meals to 3 a day. Pretty soon after that, I put down sugar. And then 3 meals a day, nothing in between. Then I started to be willing to put some boundaries around the quantities that I ate. But I had put boundaries around the amount of times a day, and that there was such thing as an end of a meal. And between the end of one meal and the beginning of another, there was absolutely nothing. Now, I worked in an office. I had a very standard day, and I ate breakfast at my desk, so which meant that I was eating breakfast sometime between 8:30 and 9 o'clock every day. And at 11 o'clock every day, like clockwork, came the snack monster. And I worked in one of those offices where there would be meetings, and when the meeting would broke up, then the lunch ladies would come by and say, there's stuff in the conference room, and we would all, run down there. And so at 11 o'clock would come that craving to either raid the conference room, go to the vending machine. And I was very lucky. In my office, there were a couple of people who were in OA that I could call and go see. And they gave me some very concrete suggestions. One of them actually said, if you, normally drink your coffee black, why don't you put a little artificial sweetener or cream in it, or have a special cup of tea, get up from your office, take a walk, and just take that little break. And that is what I did. And, of course, there's also drop your keys under your desk, and while you're down there, yeah. Or go in the bathroom, pray, whatever. So I started taking those suggestions, and within a week, the 11 o'clock craving went away and never came back. The same thing happened at 3 o'clock after lunch. My head would just, boom, hit the desk, and I wanted something, which is very natural. You know, at the same kind of time span, same process happens. Your body has metabolized the food. There's a change, drop in your blood sugar. My food plan, I think, now better manages those changes. But that's how it was back then. And same thing, the 3 o'clock craving took a little while longer to leave, but it left and never returned, except that I still want to fall asleep. But I, you know, the craving to eat at that time, the command to eat, left and never returned. And I started believing I can do this. And then I had a period of pink cloud where it was really easy. It was actually, even on hard days, it was easier to abstain than not to abstain. That was pretty cool. That didn't last, but it was loved it while it happened. Now, my sponsor says, oh, great, okay, you've put together, I don't remember, it was, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, so time for you to raise your hand to sponsor. Are you kidding? Me? Sponsor? So that was the next piece of trust. My sponsor told me, very matter-of-factly, she didn't order me, but she also made it very clear that every argument I was going to raise against it was, you know, bullshit. That was the next thing that I had to trust, because what she told me was, you're worried that you won't do it right, and that's the wrong worry, because you won't, because that's meaningless. What you are going to do is you're going to share your experience. And as long as you're telling what your experience is, you can't do that wrong. You're not responsible for getting anybody abstinent. You're not responsible for getting them to go to meetings or anything. They're responsible to you to keep you abstinent. And as long as that's going, you know, things are fine. And then the same thing with holding office. I had the same problem with working the steps. I'm not going to do this right. I was terrified to go and make a direct ninth step amends. Terrified. They will kill me. Each one of these things, when I stepped through it, I had to do it trusting that those who had told me that it worked had worked for them were telling me the truth, and that it would work for me and I wouldn't die. I had a very hard time with the notion that being free of resentment and that forgiveness was going to be good. I genuinely believed that I was going to be in some sort of peril if I even entertained the thought of letting go of certain resentments. Now, something that I haven't even really talked about, and I can't believe it. In 1997, dream came true. I married the man of my dreams. In 1998, he left me. And it was an absolute, we'd been living together for, I think, 5 years before we got engaged. So we'd been together for about 7 years. And he left me, and, you know, under really hurtful circumstances, he left me essentially for our next door neighbor. And I used to tell that as a, you know, as kind of like an ooga booga story. And I only include that detail just to convey how shocking it was and really, really awful. But this was another one of those trust things. At that time, and at this time, I had been sober, abstinent for, you know, 10 years or so. And this was a new level of surrender. And I remember thinking at that time, there was no question in my mind that I was going to continue to live according to the principles of the 12 steps. And there was also no question in my mind that I did not have the wherewithal to forgive him. Couldn't imagine doing it, which meant that there was further to go. And it was another jumping off place. It was a profound surrender and a profound exercise in trust, because it wasn't that I wanted him to be happy or anything in particular. It wasn't that I wanted, you know, oh, I want to be all spiritual. I knew that if I didn't let go of this, I was going to drown in bitterness and I was going to eat. I was going to pick up. There was no question in my mind that everything, because so far you hadn't steered me wrong and you told me with absolute certainty that in order to live according to the principles of this program, I could no longer hold on to the right to resent. That didn't mean I had to forgive that day, but it meant that I could not say, you know, this I will not let go of. You know, and I wish I could say today that there's absolutely no charge there, but it's minuscule compared to what it was. So now I don't tell it as a horror story. One of the amends that I made to him was I don't care. I don't bear the tale. I don't talk about him in negative ways. And I don't let people talk about him negatively to me. But that was a leap of faith. These were all the sorts of things that I had to trust would be all right and move forward from there. I believe that tradition, too, is the same thing. The whole time I've been in Overeaters Anonymous, and as I said this morning, we were founded in 1960. 1961 is when people started predicting our demise because of the controversy over food plans. Anybody who has done service beyond the group level has also encountered some sort of horrible scare thing. You know, our numbers are down, number of meetings are down, you know, we're all going to die. There's this new 12-step food fellowship out there. They're going to get ya. There's always something that's coming to destroy Overeaters Anonymous, and yet here we are. That has been another area in which I've really had to learn to trust, and that's in the area of doing service. Is there anybody here who has had the experience of either worrying that a meeting's going to fold or a meeting folding, and yet you're still here? I think, you know, there have been times that a meeting folding has not necessarily been the worst thing that could happen. The thing is that for me to be an OA member, I believe that all of these steps and traditions, the way they interlock, we also have this thing called the responsibility pledge. Always to extend the hand and heart of Overeaters Anonymous to all who share my compulsion, for this I am responsible. So once I take step one, I take that pledge. When I take step two, I take that pledge. To me, it's really all interwoven. So we have this responsibility of service. We all know that there's a lot of different ways of doing service. Coming here is doing service. Anyone out there who, no matter where you are in your recovery, look around. This is a power greater than you. Try to have a tug of war with everybody in the room. Try to argue that you can't recover against everybody in this room. You're going to lose. Again, those are surrenders. This is a power greater than yourself. And this is a power that can keep Overeaters Anonymous moving forward together. So here's my pitch for service as well. Your intergroup puts on two fantastic retreats a year. And that's not all your intergroup does for you. They maintain a beautiful website. They keep your meetings connected. I don't know what else they do, but they do workshops and maybe they print a newsletter, have a hotline. Oh, there's the Unity Day. Is this GSI? Yeah, okay. So you're going to have a workshop just like my intergroup is going to be doing one on February 26th. So whatever you're thinking about why you can't do service at intergroup, I've already run through the excuses in my head. It's I don't have time. Everybody can do one thing. You know, if you did one thing at this retreat, you did intergroup service. I don't know how. Somebody else does, and they will help you do it. I don't like controversy. You know, I get upset at business meetings. Tough. Addicts are characterized by the delusion that we cannot tolerate our own discomfort. And that means, you know, in business meetings, yeah, controversies arise. We disagree, and, you know, sometimes those discussions can get a little... But we have to move forward together, and that means that we have to sometimes... Well, it's, you know, that old thing about... You know, nobody would eat sausage if they saw how it was made. OA service is not always easy. It's not always pretty, but it's what our life depends on, and our life depends on the next overeater coming in the door. That's my pitch for service. And also, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for doing service beyond the group level. I wouldn't, because I would, you know, nobody would know me outside of Boston because I've never moved from Boston. I go to a bazillion meetings in Boston. You know, some of you might come into town or something like that. But it's been phenomenal. I have served in my intergroup. I have served in my region. When I was the chair of Region 6, I was able to come to the Region 1 convention. I recognize at least one person who was there at that Region 1 convention in Calgary several years ago. I was the trustee of my region for a while, and I got to go to a lot of amazing events that way. I didn't come in, I had no qualifications to do any of that stuff when I came into OA. I just had the desire that other people have what I had been given. And you know what? Now I'm sort of like, I'm not retired from service, but I don't do service on that level anymore. I think I said yesterday, I don't even have a group job right now. I have to get one at the next business meeting I go to. Been kicked out of everything. But the best way to trust that OA is going to be there for you is to be there for OA. There is no they. There is only we. And the best way to really feel like you're on the inside is to throw yourself into service. And remember that A service job is not a prison term. But it is a wonderful commitment. You know, if you're, for example, if you're a speaker bookie or something like that, that's one of my favorite jobs because I hate making phone calls. But I do it. I do it. And when I'm a bookie, I have to make a load of phone calls. And they're wonderful. Secretary or something like that, that gets me to the meeting when I might go, oh, I don't feel like going out tonight. It does require a lot of trust that you'll be okay. So in the writing exercise that we're going to do in our breakout groups, it asks kind of those questions to look honestly. Have you had a hard time trusting that you'll be okay if you do what OA asks? And, you know, I've just talked about a lot of stuff that I had concerns about. Have you experienced a time when you worried that your group or other service body was taking an action that would be harmful, which in looking back turned out for the best? You know, you may or may not have had that experience. Do you have current concerns about the OA program? Be honest. You know, if you're afraid of something, you're not going to bring it about by putting it down on the page and airing it, because chances are you're going to help somebody else who may have the same concern and be afraid to talk about it. What do you need to entrust to your higher power to be able to feel comfortable that OA will continue to be here for you? Those are my little thoughts.